Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
Yom Kippur is covered a lot of different ways, a lot of different topics, things you can talk about. Everywhere from what Messiah did and does, versus what you and I have to do or don't have to do, from a proper, meaning proper, is, I've used that term very loosely, but as far as the type of fasting or afflicting one's soul versus what is improper and the not quite the proper way of doing things as far as not within inside oneself, but rather outwardly. And you could also discuss, obviously, about the book of Hebrews. The entire book, for that matter, discusses a lot about what Messiah did and how he does stuff, as well as in the nature of how Yom Kippur and the Day of Atonement affects the globe individually or as communities. There's lots of ways of doing this, and there's a lot of different topics to focus on. So in this particular event, I was discussing a couple of different of these topics, not all of them, not thoroughly extensively, but looking at a view of them. As is tradition for all holy days, we head to our book Leviticus to cover as far as what the instructions are, because we don't want to forget what they are. Leviticus 23, of course, discusses, as we had covered back at Trumpets, also discusses Yom Kippur. Leviticus 23, in verse 26, it just says, Yehovah spoke to Moses, saying, But on the 10th day of this 7th month is the Day of Atonement, also is Yom Kippur. There shall be a holy convocation for you, and you shall afflict yourselves. You shall offer a fire offering to Yehovah. You shall not do any work on this very day, for it is a Day of Atonement to provide you atonement before Yehovah your God. For any soul who will not be afflicted on this very day will be cut off from his people. Any soul who will do any work on this very day, I will destroy that soul from among its people. You shall not do any work. It is an eternal decree throughout your generations in all your dwelling places. It is a day of complete rest for you. You shall afflict yourselves on the 9th of the month in the evening. From the evening to evening, you shall rest on your rest day. So that's the command as far as our first major introduction to the Day of Atonement. Now, this is not the first time the idea was introduced. Well, it's obviously introduced back earlier at Book Leviticus 16, discussed the goats and such, which we'll get to later. Note, in this particular day, this particular passage here on Leviticus 23, it discusses a few basic things, pretty simple, as far as obviously a day of rest on this particular day and a day of afflicting one's self. So those are two basic principles which we're focusing on as far as how it's broken apart. Those are two different ideas, or two different concepts. Afflicting yourself and resting are not necessarily the same. They're not synonymous. So we can focus on one or the other. But before we go there, Leviticus 16, we'll jump there real quick. We can just discuss a little bit about the requirements for the day itself. Because Leviticus 16, unlike 23... 16 focuses very little on what you do. Leviticus 16 talks most about what the high priest does. As I mentioned when I started out, David's only broken up into two different categories. One is what individuals do or communities, and one is what the priest does or what Messiah does. Those are two different sections, two different tasks broken apart. So they are related, but they are definitely independent from each other. Leviticus 16, it says, Jehovah spoke to Moses after the death of Aaron's two sons. When they approached before Jehovah, they died. Jehovah said to Moses, Speak to Aaron, your brother. He shall not come at all times in the sanctuary within the curtain and from the cover that is upon the ark. So he should not die. For a cloud will appear upon the ark cover. With this shall Aaron come to the sanctuary. With a young bull for sin offering, a ram for burnt offering, he shall don sacred linen tunic. Linen breeches shall be upon his flesh. He shall gird himself with linen sash and cover his head with a fine linen turban. They are sacred vestments. He shall immerse himself in water, then don them on. From the assembly of the children of Israel shall take two he-goats for a sin offering and one ram for a burnt offering. Aaron shall bring as near his own sin bull offering and provide atonement for himself and his household. He shall take the two he-goats and stand them before Yehovah at the entrance of the meeting. Aaron shall place lots upon the two he-goats, one lot for Yehovah and one lot for the wilderness. Aaron shall bring near the he-goat designated by lot for Yehovah and make it a sin offering. And the he-goat designated by lot for Azazel of the wilderness, he shall be stood alive before Yehovah to provide atonement through it, to send it out to Azazel in the wilderness. Aaron shall bring near his own sin offering bull. He shall provide atonement for himself and his household. Then he shall slaughter his own sin offering bull. He shall take a shell full of fiery coals from atop the altar that is before Yehovah, and his cupped hands full of finely ground incense spices. Bring it within the curtain. He shall place the incense upon the fire before Yehovah, so that the cloud of incense shall blanket the ark cover that is atop the tablet of testimony, so that he shall not die. Stop there for a minute. So that was Leviticus 16, the first, first 14 or so, 13 verses or so. In that section, we obviously see what Aaron the high priest is doing. Of course, what Messiah is supposed to represent, that high priest character, that position, that role, those symbols, what's being spoken of there. And in years past, I've talked about at least, I know Jeff has too at times. In years past, I talked about the nature of what the priest is doing, how he performs his functions, and what they're supposed to look like as far as how they appear. We've also discussed in the Hebrews, book of Hebrews, which discusses very detailed as far as how this process is supposed to work internally, not externally, but sort of inside your person, in your body, in your mind, in your soul. So all those things are broken up in these categories. Today, I want to focus on a little bit slightly different topic, just it's only slightly different, in that there are strange things going on with inside Day of Atonement that don't make a whole lot of sense when you look at them in detail. So for example, we see quite clearly, we have these two animals, one's for God and one's for the wilderness, or Azazel, as you discard it off into the wilderness. The one for God dies, the one in the wilderness lives, and for us, however long it's going to live, we don't know, because it's being sent off to wilderness. Either way, which one would you rather be? You're out the wilderness, right? You've got to live, right? But the wilderness brings all your sins with you. So when you're choosing which one you're going to follow, one has an immediate death, and one has a prolonged later death, right? Maybe a wild animals will get it in like 20 years from now. Who knows? I don't know how long goats live, however long they live. It'll live up until that point, right? And it could be forever. Not a problem. I'll wait. I'll live longer. But that's the one that carries all the burdens of the sins with it. The one that lives. So water of baptism, as you mentioned, the idea of death, as it is described to us, I believe Apostle Paul does so, is he mimics that or symbolizes that, or compares it, juxtaposes the right word, to being buried in dirt, right? The Messiah was buried in dirt for 3 days, he buried, you lift up, now he's alive. The water of death, you wash away your dead man, lift up, now you're alive. He parallels those two symbols. Now, in that particular event, which he's paralyzing those symbols, he's pointing out the idea that you're dead to what your past life was. That was the intent behind it. Now, it's interesting because in that parallelism, your past life, of course, represents the life of the sinful life that you lived, the things you don't want to repeat, the awful errors or other types of mistakes that may have gone through, whether they're iniquities or sins or transgressions or whatever they were. That's what the idea of death was. In that same parallel, if you look at what he was comparing to as Messiah's death, the Messiah himself didn't have any of those things, right? He didn't have the sin, the transgression, iniquities at all. There's nothing was wrong with him. Yet he was the same process. So if I'm going to make it as he uses the parallel between Messiah's burial and your baptism, let's reverse that, shall we? For the sake of discussion. So let's put his burial like your baptism, flip around, your baptism like his burial. So what was he washing away? What was he? You wash away your past life, right? Was Messiah killing off his past life?
Oh, he's a perfect God.
Right, so he couldn't kill off his past life. He didn't have a past life to kill off, right? But you have a past life to wash away, to die, to erase. Now, I realize our text... Right, daily life. That could be past. I didn't say how old the past was. It could be minutes. It could be years. I don't know. I'm not going to discuss that. So your past life to wash away. In his process of dying and what he was doing, now he didn't have a past life to kill off. Now, it states our text, I do realize the Greek is missing a word there, but that's just the way that Greek words it and phrases it, which is fine. And it says that he died, he became a sin for, he became sin for us. That's incorrect. He gave a sin offering for us, the proper wording, the proper English phrase there, is that he himself was not sin, didn't die as sin. You cannot transfer your sin and make the other thing guilty for it. Doesn't work that way. Now, what about the goats? Ah, but the goat didn't die. We transferred our sin to the live goat. It didn't die. It was carried away. It didn't die. The one who died wasn't guilty. So it's important. We make sure to understand that Messiah's death, we didn't give him our sin, making him sin itself and killing him. It didn't work that way. It is he's dying on behalf of our sin. That's a different thing. There's a sin offering. He didn't become sin. He is our sin offering. It's a different thing. The animal is never actually guilty for your mistakes, is it? No, it can't be. So you can't just claim, well, the animal did it. It's done. No. When the animal kills things, it has its own things to pay for. It's not paying for yours, paying for itself. But it's not the guilty one. Now, it dies on your behalf, because in this instance, we have a sin offering, which we're comparing it to. So Messiah's burial process, though it is likened unto the baptism that we go through, it is a little bit different in that we are actually getting rid of our previous life symbolically, of course. He didn't. He didn't get rid of our previous life or even his own previous life. He's making a payment to make that baptism actually be functionally workable. If he had not done so, that baptism doesn't actually do anything. And I'll be honest with you, seriously. And you're going in water and going down, coming up again, it really doesn't actually make you clean. I'm just saying, it's just shocking. It does not actually, it's a symbol. It doesn't actually do it. It's a symbolic process, right? So don't forget, we're discussing two symbols only, not the actual things. Yes, Ellie.
Given the list of what type of sacrifices to give for things, those animals that were sacrificed were very costly. So it costs the person least. It costs them the amount that it costs for that animal that they're going to
sacrifice. True, there is money involved as far as that's concerned. That is true. And the poorer you are, the more impact it is on your personal wallet. But I do realize, and since you brought that up, let's discuss just briefly, just for a moment. The idea of being poor and idea of sins, does sins care whether you're rich or poor? No. So they may be severe on both parties, right? Whether a rich man does a severe sin, a poor man can do also a severe sin. So the impact on whether the poor man offers a, as the cheapest one, I think, is a grain offering, is the lowest you can go. So here's some little bit of bread, that's all I've got. That's a major impact. But a rich man, that's literally pennies. It's nothing. Here, let's cast it off. But yet God does not value one over the other. I mean, the rich man has to give his own fee, whatever it happens to be. Now, I do realize that if you're excessively wealthy, a cow is cheap. If you're excessively wealthy, cow's cheap. You could, oh, here's 5 dozen. Look at Solomon. Oh, here's 1,000. It meant nothing. So we can look at, try to look at the dollar amount and the impact of your wallet, but if you want to be truly fair, we say, okay, Solomon, give me 90% of your entire wealth. Okay, now we're talking, now here's the equal to the grain of, yeah, now we're discussing, ouch, that really hurt. That's actual pain. So when we look at the financial burden, it does exist, but reality is, it's not a very good equator as far as how we're dealing with these sins. Yes, David.
Well, I was just going to add to what she was saying. And, you know, as a farmer or a keeper of a herd, you know, you're giving up something that's prized to you because it's one of your finer calves or your finer sheep. You know, it's not the one that's
this is the best
dragging
ones.
Its rear leg right. Or blind in one eye.
Right. It does have intrinsic value to, and the vast majority of people are not King Solomon, right? the vast majority are not the nobles with lots of land and have all this excessive. I'm just using obviously Solomon as an example, but realize most people aren't that way. So it does have a significant intrinsic value to it, to both the farmer as well as the people. But in this process, let's move on. I didn't want to discuss too much on the rabbit trail regarding the cost of the things. So we have some, obviously mentioned some strange things about the nature of this goat. The one who survives, the one that retains the sins and carries them with it, the one who passes, the one who dies, the one who is now finished, the sins that don't apply. They're cleansed. It's not applied to that individual, that goat. In this process of discussing this, the priest obviously does most of the stuff. We go through all of this, but he obviously, well, we can discuss the nature of the goats and as far as how the living goat and the blood getting on and all that kind of stuff happens and laying out of hands. What are the people doing during this process? Not the priest. What's the people doing? Any thoughts, opinions, things? What are they doing? Watching.
Praying.
That's fair. Not much you do, is it? Because it doesn't involve you, right? Paying for your sin doesn't involve you.
Oh, yes, it does.
Not in this, it doesn't. Not in this case, it doesn't. Now, sins may have consequences, which you're referring to. Yes, there are consequences of sins. That's not, but paying for them, the consequences don't actually pay for them. Consequences are just the fallout of whatever happened. I killed so-and-so, and now I'm in prison. That's too bad. That's a consequence. But I may be in prison for 20 years or my whole life. Does that pay for his death? No. It's just the consequence. Paying for his death is a different thing. Paying for his death requires something beyond my just imprisonment for a period of time, however long it may be. So we have these payments, which doesn't involve you. In a case, let me rephrase that. Back up. What are your tasks? I talk too fast sometimes. What are your tasks? What's your job? Well, Brandon, this happens once a year. Leviticus 16. Once per year. So what's your job during that year? That one time. There's prayer. There's waiting, observation. And of course, and there's fasting. There's those requirements. Now, in the fasting, as we pointed out in Leviticus 23, it said, whoever is not afflicting yourself is cut off. What does it mean to be cut off? Does it mean separated? It means death. Cut off to mean it means dead. So if I take a branch of a tree, I cut off the branch, what happens to the branch?
It dies.
It dies. Does it grow a new tree?
No.
I have to plant it to grow a new tree. I have to do the right timing and all the hormones that have the roots grow, blah, 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 or graft on something else. I have to do something to it. When I cut it off, it dies. So when a soul does not afflict themselves, they're cut off. Well, what does it mean to afflict yourself? Well, to fast, right? Is that it?
I think you better be searching your soul.
Searching your soul?
Asking God for forgiveness for the things you've done that past year. So
in that instance, you're referring to afflicting oneself, the fasting also associated with a discussion or a conversation with God about your past. Now, I have a lot of notes here about a whole bunch of things I can go through. I'm going to go through a few of them today, not every one of them. Let's jump to, first of the easiest, simple one, Isaiah 58, which discusses the idea of what this fasting means, which we discussed this last, I think last year we covered this. Isaiah chapter 58. The Haftorah portion actually includes part of 57 as well, but I'm not going to discuss all of the Haftorah portion. So Isaiah 58 discusses the idea of fasting and the nature of it and how it's supposed to affect you. And so you and I don't have any influence or partaking at all of what the high priest does. We didn't supply our goats, because mind you, it's not every individual supplies two goats. The priest does this. It's not. It's the whole community as a nation supplies two goats, which, mind you, be less than pennies, like fractions of tiny specks of a penny per person. So there's no money. The significant value, the monetary value of this is minimal. It's insignificant to you. So in this case, it should not really affect you directly. Isaiah 58, what is your responsibility? Cry aloud and spare not. Lift up your voice like a trumpet and tell my people their transgression and the house of Jacob their sins. Yet they seek me daily and delight to know my ways as a nation that did righteousness and did not forsake the ordinance of their God. They ask of me the ordinance of justice. They take delight in approaching God. Why have we fasted, they say, and you have not seen? Why have we afflicted our souls and you take no notice? In fact, the day of your fast, you find pleasure and exploit your laborers. Indeed, you fast for strife and for debate and to strike with the fist of wickedness. You will not fast as you do this day to make your voice heard on high. Is it a fast that I have chosen? A day for a man to afflict his soul? Is it to bow down his head like a bulrush and to spread out his sackcloth and ashes? Would you call this a fast, an acceptable day to Jehovah? Let's stop there for a minute. So, in the nature of what is being condemned, what's being corrected in the first portion of Isaiah 58? What's the commentary? What's happening here? We have a story of individuals who are saying, hey, we're obedient. We're following the procedures. We're going as just as you instructed. We're fasting. We're praying to you and yelling out, please help, help, help God, help us, help, just like we should do. We're following exactly what you told us to do. We're being obedient to you. Do you not see this? And what is his reply? They're inside. Their inside is right. It's outward show, as Jonathan pointed out. It's going through the process. It appears that we have the statement when it comes to the Bible. It says, out of the mouth proceeds the heart, right? The idea that if you continuously say something and do something over and over and over again, eventually your heart will follow that procedure. We have that concept, which generally that's true. Now, I have a question for you. Apply that to our fasting. If you go through the process of fasting over and over and over again, will not our heart eventually follow too? Well, that's the theory, right? Theoretically, it should. If we keep doing it again and again and again, eventually our heart will follow what our actions continuously do. If I continuously hate something in my mouth or my actions, eventually my heart will hate it too. If I love something in my mouth or action, my heart will love it too. The idea is that my actions will eventually, it may take a short period of time or a long period of time, eventually will affect my heart and where my heart is going. What's God's goal? Which of those two things, which would we rather have? What is his objective? What is the purpose? The heart. So his goal is the heart process. We understand that point. That's the objective. So we have to go through promotions for a heart to follow. That's the idea, isn't it? But in how we read this, continue on in verse 6. Is this not the fast I have chosen? To loose the bonds of wickedness, to undo the heavy burdens, to let the oppressed go free, and that you break every yoke? Is it not to share your bread with the hungry, that you bring into your house the poor who are cast out? When you see the naked, that you cover him, and hide not yourself from your own flesh? Then your light shall break forth like the morning, and your healing shall spring forth speedily, and your righteousness shall go before you. The glory of Jehovah shall be your rear guard. Then you shall call, and the Lord will answer. You shall cry, and he will say, here I am. If you take away the yoke from your midst, the pointing of the finger and speaking wickedness, if you extend your soul to the hungry and satisfy the afflicted soul, then your light shall dawn in the darkness, and your darkness shall be as the noonday. The Jehovah will guide you continually and satisfy your soul in drought and strengthen your bones. You should be like a watered garden and a spring of water whose waters do not fail. Those from among you shall build the old waste places. You shall raise up the foundations of many generations. And you shall be called the repairer of the breach, the restorer of streets to dwell in. Stop there for a minute. So what is his reply? What do we understand from the second, the middle portion of Isaiah 58? What do we learn from this part? We understood the beginning part, that the whole idea of, well, we went through the motion, the actions, the tasks, which was designed, intent, to our heart to follow. That was the idea. But is that effective? Sometimes. Sometimes. Not thoroughly, though. What's missing in that part? What did he describe in the middle section? What does it explain what's missing? Oh, go ahead, Jonathan.
I was going to point out that he said that the servants, these people would have their servants working.
Right.
And so that would kind of go against the whole idea. If you know, you're taking it off, mm-hmm. and you're having your servants
having
work.
Having your servants work.
So there's that. And then, right. and then he's, I guess he's trying to show them, you know, what a true fast is. What a true affliction is.
If your goal is to get God to hear you, pay attention to what he's asking for. Now, I want to point to this, because we're going to go to this today. I have plenty of time, because you're not going to go eat. Lots to talk about. I won't waste all your time. Don't be wrong. There's something I want to understand, how we understand this. It's very, very, very out of place with inside our God and with inside our Bibles, in that he has laws and instructions. But he also has oaths, which are separate. Now, an oath, we will discuss as far as the nature of the character of the individual, is how this oath is going to plays out. As John was pointing out, as far as how you treat other people, you fault yourself and nobody else. Oaths are independent of the Torah. That's funny, because they're inside the Torah, but they're also independent. And that when God makes a promise or an instruction, it can be within the Torah. It can also be outside the Torah too. And when it's outside the Torah, it trumps the Torah's law. Think, how could that be? Simple. One of the most common oaths we ask for, we understand, is the oath of mercy. Is mercy outside the Torah's instruction? Absolutely. How do I know that? If you have a sin, you have a transgression, you have an iniquity, these are the consequences. It's a pretty basic formula. And then sometimes the consequences are so severe we can't pay them. What do we ask for? Let's go outside the law and say, God, can I have mercy on this? And he decides yes or no, depending on the circumstances of each individual. So they say that mercy lives outside of the law, which is funny because actually it's talked about with inside the law, but it lives outside of it because it gets to jump around and move around within the law's context and move outside of it. So oaths fall in that category because God makes oaths, promises that actually contradict or pull out of a Torah within the Torah's instruction. Say, well, yeah, I did this. However, I'm doing this in its place and insert new sections inside the Torah. We'll discuss that as we'll get there to later on today. So within that context, oaths are outside the Torah because that's how we get our promises, that's how we get our mercies, that's how we get the kindnesses from God are living outside of it. They can move around as they see fit whenever God decides it's time to apply it here versus apply it there. Now, in the case of an individual, John was pointing out, so you have an individual who's following the instructions, following the letter of the law, exactly what it's supposed to be, as well as the idea of your heart will follow it, but their heart wasn't following it. They're not applying this same principle of life to their whole life, rather just a section of it, a portion of their life. Well, they were following the law instructions, but it didn't follow the law in its ideal or the purpose behind it, right? We understand it doesn't follow the purpose behind it. Isaiah 58, the middle of the section, which we read just a few minutes ago, discussed something which is very important. What was the idea behind it? So you fasted. Good job. Happy for you. What about anybody else? How'd you treat them? Did you care? Did you even notice anybody else? Were you focused on your own hunger? What about everybody else's hunger? Your own needs? What about everybody else's needs? How do we apply this? Because remind you, back in Deuteronomy chapter 11, which we read a while back, as well as chapter 7, chapter 11, both to say something very specific. One of the specific things they talk about is God's charge, who he's in charge of. And who is he in charge of? Well, he says quite clearly, those who are poor, those who are the outcasts, those who are mistreated and uncared for. Those are the ones that he takes control of. So if you have a fasting individual who does the best they can for them in their own lives, what about those who are suffering? Well, God says, good job for taking care of yourself, but all these other thousands that I have to cover and take care of that you aren't helping with, where is your fasting? Where is your prayer for them? Where is your effort for them? Which is what he railed against in Isaiah 58. We'll continue. We'll finish off chapter 58, the last two verses, verse 13 of Isaiah 58. It says, if you turn away your foot from the Shabbat and from doing your pleasure on my holy day and call the Sabbath a delight, the holy day of Jehovah honorable, and honor him not doing your own ways, nor finding your own pleasure, nor speaking your own words, then you shall delight yourself in Jehovah, and I will cause you to ride on the high hills of the earth and feed you with the heritage of Jacob, your father. The mouth of Jehovah has spoken. So if you correct your paths, not just the actions you're following, but your intent behind them, and those who it affects, all those around you, that's when God says, now I'll pay attention to you. Now I will listen. Now it is affecting your heart. How do we know it's affecting your heart at that point? How do we know when your actions transfer from going through the process, your goal is for your heart to follow it, to where your heart actually got there? How do we tell the difference? How do we know? Well, what does Isaiah 58 just say? How do we know? How does God know? Well, what is the actions? What's it saying? Isaiah 58 had listed off earlier, a few verses earlier, that is it not to share your bread with the hungry, verse 7? Do you bring your house the poor who are cast out? You see naked that you cover him? How are you treating somebody else? Right? That's what God notices. How are you treating somebody else? Note, afflicting your soul is yourself, isn't it? Your own belly, your own stomach, right? Well, how does God know that that afflicting of your soul affects inside your heart? Because how you treat someone else. Hatred of the people, your community around you. That's how he measures it. He said that quite plainly many times over and over and over in the Torah. How you treat the poor, the fatherless, the widow, the stranger in your gates. Remember, you were once like them. How do you treat them? That's how his measure. That's his measuring tool. That's his measuring stick. That's what he's using to verify your heart actually is following through. It actually does make sense. That you actually are paying attention. That's his tool he uses. So remember that when we're measuring ourselves, God, are you pleased with my work, with my fasting, whatever I'm doing? It's simple. How much is everybody else around me? How much of my community, those who are poor, those who are suffering? If you're treating them well, you already know how God feels toward you. Because he knows it's in your heart to do so. It is. You truly treat somebody else the same way you treat yourself. You have your hearts there. Your heart finally caught up with your actions. What if it never gets there? Well, you're back to the first verse, first like five verses of 58. You're stuck there. Move past it. Get past those first few verses and actually move into actually treating others a particular way. That's what we talk about today, about the others. I like the others. So Hebrews chapter 7 and chapter 8, we'll jump through real quick. I'm not going to say they're very long because I'm going to spend most of my time today in Jeremiah and Ezekiel. But Hebrews 7 and 8 discusses some very specific things. Now, this course is discussing, I'm not going to go into all the details of, you know, priesthoods and Melchizedek and all those various details, blah, blah, blah. I'm not covering all that stuff. That's an in-depth discussion and worthwhile studying, but not a day which I haven't eaten much because my mind is not clear. Maybe yours is, but mine is not. So Hebrews chapter 7, so it discusses a few details. I'm not going to do the whole thing, the part of it though. Jump down to which one I want to stop at. I think I want to go You should do the whole chapter, but I don't think I want to cover the entire chapter. It's a little excessive reading. I might. Okay. Let's jump down to, starting verse 4. Hebrews 7, starting verse 4. I mean, the first maybe 10 verses or so. Now consider how great this man was, to whom even the patriarch, this is the reference to Melchizedek from years past. The patriarch Abraham had given a tenth of his spoils, and indeed those who are the sons of Levi who received the priesthood have a commandment to receive tithes of the people according to law, that is, from the brethren through they have come from the loins of Abraham. But he whose genealogy is not derived from them receives tithes from Abraham and blessed him who had promises. That beyond all contradiction, the lesser is blessed by the better. Here mortal men receive tithes, but there he receives them, of whom it is witnessed that he lives. Even Levi, who receives tithes, paid tithes to Abraham, so to speak, for he was still in the loins of his father Melchizedek when he met him. Therefore, if perfection were through the Levitical priesthood, for under it the people received the law, what further need was there that another priest should arrive according to the order of Melchizedek and not be called according to the order of Aaron? For the priesthood being charged of necessity, there was also change of law, for he of whom these things are spoken belongs to the tribe which no man has officiated in the altar. Let's stop there for a minute. This is a bunch of gobbledygook. So, we have two problems. He's addressing two problems, right? Who is Aaron? The high priest, he does all the stuff with the goats and everything else, right? So he only does so much. And he obviously, the book of Hebrews discusses this quite extensively. I'm looking for all of it. I'll give you a rundown quick because I'm going to jump to the section real quick. And the book of Hebrews says, obviously, Messiah was supposed to fulfill this role, but that's also impossible because it's against the law for Messiah to fill this role. Messiah is not from Levi. He's not from Aaron. You broke the law. So you cannot have Messiah inserted in as high priest. He's not a descendant of Aaron, as is the commandment of the law. But to do so, you've broken the Torah. That's what he's pointing out. That's what happens. You've broken the Torah. You can't do it. So if you're going to do this, you have to alter, to change the Torah to do that. Well, who has the authority to change Torah? God alone. But where did God say he would do so? Now, because God would have to write within the Torah the ability for God to break the Torah. Because if God is outside the Torah, something's wrong. You'd say, wait a minute, God, you told me to test anyone who says not follow the Torah law, and you're saying I shouldn't follow the Torah law. God, you're now contradicting yourself. You become a liar, God. Because he can't do that. So what the Hebrews is arguing is, that would be true. However, God put within inside the Torah the ability to do this by making a priest ahead of time that was outside of Aaron's lineage. And hence Melchizedek existed as a priest prior to Aaron. Therefore, we have a precedent that God already pre-set up so that God could break his Torah commandment on Aaron's line and jump over to the Melchizedek line and continue on from there. So that's the book he was just talking about. So because God cannot break his own Torah and tell us to break his Torah, that would be ridiculous. You can't do that. God, that makes no sense. You have to have a method, a vehicle, a tool by which you can do that. All right? The Hebrews just talked about this process, this tool by which it happens. Because again, if you looked at Isaiah 58 carefully, which we just read earlier, it said to share your food with the hungry. Wait a minute. Didn't we read Leviticus 23? Whoever does not afflict their souls is cut off from Israel. So if I say, oh, you're so hungry, here, have some food. Poor Jonathan. Oh, I just cut your soul off. Bummer. Oops. So something's wrong. So Isaiah 58 has an insertion there. So wait a minute, share my food with the hungry instead of on my fasting time? And I, what? You're commanding me to break the Torah's law by sharing my food with somebody who's hungry on a day which you commanded no one should eat or drink to afflict your soul. I'm confused, Father. This makes no sense. Because he's jumping out around and around and he's intermixing symbols and scenarios that should not be intermixed unless he wrote within the Torah a tool by which you can do that. And there is one. David, you have your hand up?
Yeah, I was just going to say that if you look at verse 12 of Hebrews 7, where the word in my Bible is changed, but the Greek word is also transferred,
right,
which goes right into what you're saying.
Which is more consistent.
Yes.
The transfer is more accurate.
Yes.
Because instead of taking the Torah and chucking away or altering the words, he isn't. There actually are two simultaneous priesthood households, so to speak, that exist in the Torah. There is a side that the high priest follows, the line of Aaron, the side that Melchizedek, we can debate whether he was a biological human or not, I don't care. What his line was supposed to symbolize, what his line was supposed to represent. So there are two channels, there are two tools, two active things going on with inside our Torah's instruction. Hence, he can jump from one line to the other. Now, Melchizedek's line does not belong to the Levite line. Melchizedek's line was prior to that. It belongs to what it appears to be anyone. Now, within our Torah, there's instructions, just as a side note, there's instructions on how an ordinary shmo can say, I'm going to join up with the priesthood for a period of time and serve. We call it the Nazirite vow. So there's a tool of which a human can do that to Levite's priesthood line. There is also a method by which someone can do it through the Melchizedek priest line. The method is, God appoints you. God appoints you. If you're a... Go ahead.
That's the reference he makes also when he says that, you know, the Melchizedek priesthood doesn't have any lineage or...
Right.
He's not saying that that person is without that. It's just saying that it doesn't have to follow the lineage.
It doesn't have to follow the lineage. Exactly. So you can insert. So God made a parallel system that we know very, very little about because it doesn't talk about Melchizedek's priest line or what they do or anything else. It doesn't discuss that topic. Our Torah was not interested in that process. That was not for man to understand at that time. It discusses obviously Aaron's line. So we have this process which we have contradictory things going on with inside our instruction, and God saying, well, they all apply. How could all these things apply? We have contradictory things. How is this possible? Because there's tools by which God wrote with inside his words that allow this to happen. Yes, Ellie.
Be a timing issue, because if you come on Day of Atonement once a year, you have another 360 days.
Yeah.
When we do new moons, we come and we have a box and we actually write down what our offering was that month. Mm-hmm. And an offering can be to provide food for someone. That is an offering. So if I, at the Day of Atonement, I come in after a year and I have come in on New Moon for 12 months and I've written down what service and who I fed or who I donated to, that still is on the chart when I'm going in before him on the records there.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think he's always asking me, did you feed somebody today? He's saying, hey, you know that family?
Had you cared for them?
Yeah. Right. Did you help when you could have?
Right.
And that's written down.
That's how we're dealing with these tools by which he allowed us to work with. There's a method, there's an instruction or a written out a command that Moses gave us. If you recall this, Messiah quotes it, though he adds the word mind, but love the Lord your God with your heart, your soul, and your strength, right? We hear that, the Torah, it's written up, it's to do so, and of course, love your neighbor as yourself. We have this instruction which we've already given. What if all those things, remember Messiah's parable, what the Samaritan and the guy who's beaten up on the ground? Yeah. Did that happen? Could that have happened any day of the week? Sure. Could it have happened on a holy day or on a Shabbat? Yes. So would it be wrong for the Samaritan to say, well, you know, it's Shabbat, therefore I'll wait till the sun goes down. That's in 14 hours from now. I'll be back. Chill out. Don't worry. The buzzards will stay away for a while. Right. I give you my umbrella, but then that's work. All these things. So, there's timing applied, but there's timing which... Over supersedes, or application, sorry, that supersedes timing. Those events, we can supersede it, which is fine too. So we have his instruction, obviously this thing happens. So our love heart, mind, soul thing, and our strength. Our love is the objective, right? We said that earlier, that your actions are supposed to have your heart to follow. We know our heart followed when we treat everybody else the way God would want them treated. Know our heart's there. We're at the spot where God says, well done. That's what I'm after. Because these are the people who's in charge of. So we have this individual on the ground, beaten up. Was our actions say this? Our heart says to do this, and we follow through. Here's we did the job. We did it well. And God says, here's a mark, checkbox of your 5 million lists to do. You got one down. Good luck for the next. But the point is, that your whole life, we understand that process works. That's how it's supposed to work. That's the idea behind it. And of course, we deal with fasting. God, look at me, look at me, look at me. Well, he says, fine, I'm looking at you, but I'm not seeing much. Where's your list of things, the things you're taking care of, the others you treat? So we have this, the idea of the outward application of what we inward are trying to do. So of course, we have these scenarios which God gives us the tools by which we can override or supersede sections or portions of the Torah at given situations, scenarios. Whether it's a day of atonement and so-and-so is dying of starvation, what happens? Oh, I'll wait till tomorrow. No, you don't. Here, have some water. Have a piece of bread. Live. Don't die. Right? So we have this idea that we can apply. We're not trying to cut his soul off. That's not our objective. The objective is to make him live. That tomorrow he can still live and say, okay, who is this God? That kind of thing. That's the idea to apply it. So we have the scenario or timing can be influenced or overridden by the need, by a requirement. Now, jumping in Hebrews chapter, we go back to where we were in Hebrews. We're going to skip through a section because I want to discuss all of the nature of how God did this process of switching priesthood from one line to the other, because that's not my topic for today. We jump to chapter 8. I just want to get that under our belt that God can do things if he has a tool written down or instruction or method by which he wrote down to do it. And I say that very carefully, try to say it carefully, and that I don't usually try to apply God breaking his Torah. That's not an accurate description. And I'm not going to say that God does not have the capability to operate outside of what his words are. However, I want to point out the only way you and I know our God is strictly by the words he spoke. If he spoke no words, you and I would have no clue he ever existed. In fact, we wouldn't exist because he spoke, let there be light. It's only through his words that he spoke, the actual things written down, that we actually know our God even exists. I mean, try talking out to him now. He's going to talk to you back. Hopefully not. If he does, maybe you should have a psych look at you. It's like, I just look at you. But he doesn't have conversations that way. Granted, I realize he did way back when Moses, okay, he's an exception. Note the exception, not the rule. So, but the only way we know he spoke to Moses because Moses wrote those words down. We know him strictly by the words he wrote. So everything, when it says that in the beginning was the word, well, yeah, it was his word saying, yeah, let there be light. We know him because he spit something out of his mouth. We call them words. He wrote the words down. That's how we know our God. If he didn't write them down, didn't have words, we would not know he existed. It wasn't written down for us. So that's how we know him. So for him to go outside of his words, that's outside of what we know. We only know what his words are. So he operates outside of his words. That's not written down for us. We don't know him. We don't know that part of him at all. So I won't say he can't do it, but we don't know him if he does. That section, that portion of him that works outside of the words he's given to us, we don't understand that. We can guess and speculate. We don't understand it, though. Yes, Deborah.
What I believe is that, I know we've all read the Bible, and you go back maybe 5 years later, and then you say, wow, I didn't see that. I didn't know that it meant that. And I think sometimes God can obscure things from your eyes. And just like when you've lost something, you go looking for it and you went past it 20 times, you didn't see
right,
it.
Right, the snake.
I believe
you.
That's how the word is that yeah. In his timing, that's how he gets,
that's how he,
it's how he uses.
Right.
I think he reveals to us that, you know what, maybe you weren't ready for this
mm-hmm.
or the world or the nation or the group or whatever. And so I think that stuff is inserted there because like you said, if he can't lie, I think it's our understanding
is concealed,
right?
So his words are there. One of the advantages of words is that as time goes on, we understand words better. When you're three and someone tries to explain to you love, okay, they explain it with the liking someone with, you know, affection. That's great. When you're 103 and says, what is love? It's actually different because you have all the history you lived through and said, I have seen what love is like in all the various ways it's manifests itself. I have a complete definition of the word love. Now, let's apply it to every word there is, the dictionary. Those that you know. the 10% of the words we know in the dictionary. All those words, they get fleshed out as our life lives. So when we read something, we can read past it one time or two times or 100 times. But as time goes on, as you point out, as time elapses, experience elapses, you go back and read the same word before. Wait a minute. That strikes up a new memory or a more recent one I can add to my previous repertoire. Now I have a whole list of a deeper understanding. So words are advantage to our God. He can write the word down and then through your experience can define it for you over 30 years or 100 years. It's written there, but our understanding of it changes over time because we deepen its understanding, which is good. It's a great advantage as opposed to pictures. They kind of look the same. He doesn't do picture books. Go figure. If he did, picture book Bible. I'm sure somebody's done one by now. Little kid books. Let's move on. So let's jump through here. So in Hebrews chapter 8, we jump to a section which I wanted to talk about as far as the method by which God does something and how he can overrule through a tool he's given, overrule a portion of the Torah for either a period of time or for a lifetime or for a millennia. He can take sections, say, I'm going to delete this out for a period of time, or whether it's short or a long period, makes a difference. So he has a tool he wrote in the Torah to do that. We'll read about it real quick here. Hebrews chapter 8. Let's see, I'm going to jump to... Actually, start the first verse. This is the main point of the things we are saying. We have such a high priest who is seated at the right hand of the throne of majesty in heavens, a minister sanctuary, the true tabernacle which the Lord erected and not a man. For every high priest appointed to offer both gifts and sacrifices, therefore it is necessary this one also have something to offer. For if he were on earth, he would not be a priest, since there are priests who offer the gifts according to the law, who served the copy of the shadow of heavenly things, as Moses was divinely instructed when he was about to make the tabernacle, for he said, see that you make all things according to the pattern shown to you on the mountain. But now he has obtained a more excellent ministry, inasmuch as he is also a mediator of a better covenant, which was established on better promises. For that first covenant, verse 7, had been faultless and no place been sought for a second. Stop there for a minute. Say again. Say what? What's wrong with the covenants? Is there a tool inside our Torah that God could say, I'm going to rewrite and alter and swap out one agreement for another one? God said he doesn't lie. How's he going to swap out bait and switch? Sign here. No, sign there. I meant this one. No, I'll put this one on top and you can remember, and there's a carbon copy beneath it that you can't see. Ha, you signed over here too. Does God do that? Is that not deceitful? Would that not be deceitful? Yes, it would be deceitful. If you have signed here in the paper, but beneath it is a carbon copy, but it says something totally different. And your signature writes down, and you see the top one, I see the bottom sheet, say, hey, look, you signed it. We call it, that's deceitful. How can you swap a covenant out? How can you swap an agreement out? What tool did God say you can swap this out? Now, if you read the fine print, we say, wait a minute, I like the second one better, but this doesn't matter. We assigned one. How can he do this? What tools do you have that allow this to occur? Yes, Rose.
Well, for one, when he was dealing with the house of Israel, that's just what he did. He dealt with the whole house. And in the new covenant, he said, I will take each person on an individual basis, and I will write that law in their heart.
Now, we're going to talk about that today, because that particular covenant didn't happen here. That covenant happened hundreds of years earlier. Ezekiel and Jeremiah both talk about it. Well, Jeremiah says to come. Ezekiel says already here. Ezekiel, it's already here. Don't you understand? It's already here. It's an individual process, which is legitimately true. Your point is correct. It's individual. But it was always individual as well as community. So what is this strange covenant swapping that we're discussing, that's being talked about, that we're looking for? Yes, Jeff.
Seems like the Lord programmed the Torah with an if-then statement.
That's a good example. If this happens, then that will happen. So the covenant we have has stipulations, instructions in there that say, hey, this is what you will follow. If this procedure happens, this is the natural following, the fallout, the what will then follow suit or come next. If these other things happen, this other stuff comes along. The covenant we have has many channels and diverse paths it can travel through. Now, does that mean he discards any part of it? No. How do we know? Well, why not? I don't understand. How come? If I went down path A, am I also going down path B too? Yes. But I didn't. Right. All will go to one path. Everyone can make it. And have a great example, which you just pointed out. So you have a lot of different ways you can get there. Ways you can live. The ways you can live. Remember we discussed earlier that there were two priesthoods going along? And God could insert someone from one over to the other, not backwards, but you can go one the other direction. Right? The whole Melchizedek presence. Does that mean if I go down path A, I'm also going down path B at the same time? Yes. Because I can say, I don't like path A anymore. Oh yeah, jump on path B. Oh crud, I like path A better. There are two ways of life. Moses gave us, there are two ways of life. You choose life or death, but you can always jump from life to death at any point in time. And you can always jump from the death life back to life at any point in time. The choices are always there. The covenant you're living all the paths at the same time. Yes, David.
Yeah, exactly what you're talking about. It's kind of, in our English translation, it's kind of a misjustice because it talks about the mediator of a better covenant, which has been enacted on better promises, but then they insert the word covenant in verse 7, for if that first covenant had been faultless, and what it's actually talking about is the priesthood.
Right.
Because it ends with, for finding fault with them.
Right.
Not the covenant.
Not the covenant itself.
So it's transferring covenant the priesthood.
Exactly. The priesthood was not sufficient up to the job. Jeff, you had your hand up a minute ago. Go ahead.
I was just saying that, just like the Torah seems to be programmed with if-then statements, it seems also to have while-else statements in there as well. While this is running, do this.
Yeah, yeah.
And if it's not running, then else do that.
I'll do that. Right,
and
right.
That is what we call the stacking covenants. Mm-hmm. We got the Abrahamic covenant. We got the Mosaic covenant.
Because they're simultaneous.
Those are while this is running, you can do this running. But if that's not running, then do this.
Right. There's always a path exists.
Nature, he programmed nature to do that.
You're right, it does.
So the Torah, we see the same thing going on there.
Exactly. So we have different covenants can apply all at the same time. And depending on the scenario, which one's going on, which one's active in your personal life, how many of you believed in God 15 years ago? Right? How many of you are on the exact same path you were 15 years ago? No. There's an exception. So, the path, there's always exceptions, right? So the path you're on. So we've jumped around. So different times, our agreement and our understanding of God has changed, hasn't it? Now, were we not following God before? Well, yes, we were. We're still following the path he wrote for us, but yet our paths have changed still. Do we know people who were where we were 15 years ago? Yes. Are they not following God? Of course they're following God. He didn't say the path doesn't exist anymore.
Right.
It's still active and functional. So hence, the tool he gave us, and this is quoted, by the way, in chapter 8 of Hebrews. We're going to Jeremiah to actually read in greater depth what's being said here. But It says, there would be no fault looking for a second one. Because finding, verse 8, because finding fault with them, he says, behold, the days are coming, says Jehovah, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel, the house of Judah, not according to the covenant that I made with their fathers in the day which I took them by hand to lead them out of the land of Egypt, because they did not continue my covenant and I disregarded them, says Jehovah. For this the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, says Jehovah. I will put my laws in their mind and write them on their hearts. I will be their God and they shall be my people. None of them shall teach his neighbor, none his brother, saying, know the Lord, for they shall all know me from the least to the greatest. Stop there for a minute. So, this covenant that he's talking back in Jeremiah, by the way, 600 years earlier. When Jeremiah is talking about this, we'll jump to Jeremiah in a minute. That's Jeremiah chapter 31, so he's quoting. We'll jump to 30 and 31 in a few moments. But he's talking about this event. He's talking about Jeremiah. He says, behold, the days are coming. You mean they aren't there at Jeremiah's time? I beg to differ. Did Jeremiah love God? Was God's commandments written on Jeremiah's heart? Were they on his mind? Yeah. So was Jeremiah a partaker of that covenant already? Yes. Let's go back a little further. Moses. Was Moses' heart, and were God's laws written on Moses' heart? Yes. Were written in his mind? Yes. Well, isn't Moses the one who gave, well, how about Abraham? So Abraham, now granted, he didn't have all the law, but there are certain things he knew. But the laws of God written on Abraham's heart. Yes. The ones he understood, he'd written very well. Whatever we don't know what he understood. It doesn't matter. On his mind, yes. Well, that's before Moses. God, how new is this covenant you're talking about? Huh. You know, I wonder, exactly, what about Adam and Eve? Now, we say Adam and Eve, but they ate the tree. Yeah, they did.
They knew better.
They knew better.
About as new as every new moon.
Right. let's go all the way back to the beginning. So this covenant that Jeremiah is quoting, that behold, the days are coming, it already existed way, 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 way back. We know that just because we know the men who were written about and the lives they lived. I mean, Joseph? Of course. Look at the life he lived. How many of us could withstand what he did? Don't raise your hand. Not many, if you can keep it to yourself. The reality is, it would be very, very difficult. But it was in his heart, his mind to do it. Now, he didn't have the law to read. He just knew his God. So this covenant that Jeremiah is referring to, that behold, it's coming, it didn't happen because Messiah died. It already existed generations before. From the very beginning, it happened. Ezekiel 18, as Rose had pointed out earlier about the individual. Ezekiel 18, Jeremiah also quotes this, so I'm not going to. It's the same process. The two men quote each other on this, or at least one quotes the other one for certain. Ezekiel chapter 18 discusses this, just to address Rose's comment. Ezekiel 18, it says, this is a section. It says, the word of the Lord came to me, Jehovah came to me. What do you mean when you were saying this proverb, because in the land of Israel, saying the fathers have eaten sour grapes, the children's teeth are on edge? As I live, says Jehovah God, you shall no longer use this proverb in Israel. Behold, all souls are mine. The soul of the Father as well as the souls of the Son is mine. The soul who sins shall die. But if a man is just and does what is lawful and right, if he has not eaten on the mountains or lifted up his eyes, the idols of the house of Israel, nor defiled his neighbor's wife, nor approached a woman during her impurity, he has not oppressed anyone, but has restored the debtor to his pledge, has robbed no one by violence, but has given his bread to the hungry, and covered the naked with clothing. If he has not exacted usury or taken any incense, but has withdrawn his hand from iniquity and executed true judgment between a man and a man, if he has walked by statutes and kept by judges faithfully, he is just. He shall surely live, says Jehovah God. So that proverb, the whole sour grapes, sunset on edge, that's, oh no, what'd dad do? Now God's going to punish us also. So they no longer use that proverb because the dad is guilty for his own screw-ups. I'm guilty for mine. So it doesn't carry on. The proverb is no longer used. Now that proverb shouldn't be used, should never have been used, because it's not what our God does. Our God does not repay me for the sins of my father. Doesn't repay you or your children for the sins of you, right? You are for your own. Your screw-ups are your own screw-ups, which means your successes are also your own successes. Hence, Job, don't forget Job, his successes belong to him, not his children like he tried to transfer. It's not, you can't transfer righteousness through inheritance. It doesn't work that way. It's individual. So you can't, more power to him if he figures out a way, but it doesn't work that way. So the transferring of responsibility does not apply to everyone. Now, I have a question for you, just so we cover all our bases. I won't forget this because somebody will bring it up, I'm sure. Well, what about all the diaspora? All the people were punished for all these years for what the nobles and the kings and the leaders all did. They were all punished for it for generations, a couple thousand years now. It wasn't just the kings and nobles and leaders, guys. It was each individual. You're all guilty of it. Now, righteous will sometimes get swept up with the unrighteous in a massive sweeping. But just like Ezekiel was swept up like everybody else, what happened to him? Well, he was cast out of everybody else, but God stayed with him. So he experienced the casting out process. He himself was not punished, though. Okay, you could argue laying on your side for like a year and a half would be punishment. It would be. But that wasn't pleasant. But still, the act of the actual slaughtering and the killing was not applied to him. Now, in the case of Jeremiah, that was a little different story. Yeah, you don't marry because your wife won't make it. Don't have children because your children are going to die. He was warned ahead of time, you're not going to do these things as a normal man does because they would die anyway. So don't bother. It's not worth your effort. But that's, again, he's not being punished for his own action. Sorry, he's not being punished for his action. He's being swept up within the whole community. Now, what we understand that means then is that God will not necessarily hold each individual responsible for the whole community's failure. But each individual may be swept up along with the community if the community continues on a path. Ever read the story of Sodom and Gomorrah and Lot? What happened to Lot's other children?
They died.
Were his other children evil and corrupt? Well, there's no indication they were. But what happened? Because they didn't leave when they were told to leave, they got swept up too. So a righteous person still has a responsibility to pay attention to what God's telling them. Now, in Jeremiah's time, in Ezekiel's time, could a righteous person have said, wait a minute, this country's corrupt and rotten. I'm going to ignore what my leaders tell me. I'm going to go do the right thing. Yes. We actually have instructions and examples of individuals who do that. They should tell us these stories, these examples of people who actually said, hey, you guys are so corrupt, I'm not going to follow you. I'm going to live my own life parallel to yours. I'm going to live my own life my own way, according to my God, what God has instructed me. And God even commends individuals, talks to them. And Jeremiah actually talks about a few of them, interviews them, and says, hey, well done. So we have examples of you as a righteous person can live in spite of the surroundings around you. But don't be shocked if you, not leaving, get swept up with everybody. But if you do leave, well done. Just bring God with you. Bring God with you. Don't forget that part. You can leave. Leave where you go. So we have... Oh, yes, Ellie. Go ahead.
Kill him. He left. He came here and he said, you know what? I've got to go back and they're going to kill me, but I'll go anyway. Mm-hmm. And he went back to help. And that was... great service. That was the ultimate.
Mm-hmm. He died for the greater love of his own man than died for his friend. Yeah, that's an example of one. So we have these great examples of these scenarios in which we have this understanding that God has has his Torah written out, his instructions to follow, but he says, but there are circumstances which I've written out from Adam and Eve onward about within your heart, within your mind, within your soul, if you love me, you will follow these tools, these paths that allow you to jump temporarily or permanently outside a Torah application and survive and live and be righteous for it. How many of us have offered our sin offerings this past year? I hear silence. How about you? You could argue you talk to God about it. How many lambs you offer? Or a goat? Yeah. What is that? That's called jumping outside the Torah's instruction via what tool? An oath, an agreement, a contract that God says, this runs parallel to your existence. Now let's go back in time prior to Messiah's life and death. The temple exists temporarily. You're alive, but Ezekiel's alive, right? Their armies are coming periodically. They're coming and going and capturing people, and wars happen. And you're amongst those who are captured and taken off to Never Never Land, wherever it is. Do you still sin while you're there? Sometimes. Is the temple there to offer your burnt offerings and sacrifices? No, it's not. So what does that mean? Well, God says a soul doesn't offer his offering, or sin offering, doesn't do the goat process, doesn't afflict his soul. He's all cut off, so I'm dead. But yet I'm not. Because Ezekiel didn't die. Well, he did eventually, but not for that. He died of old age, or whatever he died of. You were allowed to live still and not get cut off. So we have examples of even before Messiah was born, lived, and died, that by an agreement, God can write, say, hey, I'm going to take you out of the situation where you cannot apply, as just pointed out, the different parallel covenants. You cannot apply this section at this time in your life or forever. Because the Vestal Temple was wiped out, right? Even forever, there's a time, even but before Messiah was born. So there wasn't a Messiah to offer for your sins. None of those options, none of that existed. But yet, you were still pulled out, and you don't have a choice anymore. But you're going to live this way. And you're going to live in this particular path. You follow these rules and these instructions because you love God. So we have these examples of our love of God and our obedience to him can supersede or go outside of Torah instructions and be righteous still. It's quite impressive, isn't it? Not breaking the Torah they're not breaking the Torah's laws, but they are breaking the Torah's instructions. Because the instructions for offering an animal when you sin is an instruction. It's a law, but it's an instruction too. A law you can argue it many different ways. This is how I view laws versus instructions. The laws are things what you do and don't do, or how to live, how not to live. Instructions about how you work with or deal with inside these laws, how to functionally make them work, right? So I can ask God to forgive my sins. That's an action. But I can also, there's instruction, how do I go through this process? We have obviously examples of the offerings and sacrifice to do so. So that those instructions, that's how I view them. Now you don't agree with me, that's how I view them though. So in the case of Ezekiel, did he sin again? Of course, every human does. He's flesh and blood. But did he live it? Did he live anyway? In the case of Daniel, right? Where are his sin offerings? He didn't have any. Just give you a heads up. They weren't there. What about his three friends? They didn't have any either. And what happened? They lived anyway. But they were righteous outside of the Torah's instructions. How is that possible? Because God wrote down, if you love me, I'll write these in your heart, in your mind, your soul. He tells that in Jeremiah, but he did it years and years and years and years and years earlier. We have examples of people who did it, who lived that way. So our instructions, we have to go back to where we were in the Torah, as far as how our Day of Atonement is supposed to function and work. It is an action-based holy day. You're afflicting your soul. You're not eating. You're praying to God. The idea is that your heart will then follow those prayers. Those actions will eventually lead you to desire to not have to screw up or not screw up again. That's the idea behind it. It will lead you that way. You're out of the mouth, feed the heart. But eventually, you don't know if your heart actually made it. And so you realize, oh, look around me. How do I interact with people around me? Am I treating them the way I would want God to treat me? Am I treating them the way I want them to treat me? How am I interacting with people? Do I truly love people? Do I actually care about what God commanded me to do? And one of the things he commanded me to do was take care of his charge, those who he takes care of. He says, the poor, fatherless, widow, the stranger, and Levite too. Take care of them. All right? So I need to take care of them too. How am I treating them? That tells me what's inside me, my desire to treat that individual. Those people that God commands and says, these are my people also. One of the primary reasons he commands us to do those categories, those five individual categories, is because he says quite clearly over and over and over and over and over and over again, and Isaiah in particular, Jeremiah covers it a whole bunch of times, that guess what? That's you. It's you. You are the poor. You are the fatherless. You are the widow. At different times in your life, you have been, and for certain, when the great exodus comes, you will be. Every one of you will. All of us will be. So again, treat others that you want to be treated. Guess what? I see poor fatherless widow. I better treat them the way I want to treat it because I know I'm destined to be there as God said so. The nations will vomit me out and kick me out and say, get out of here. You're a horrible person. You're evil. This God of yours, get out of here. That's how I'm going to be treated someday. I may not be alive. I don't know. My children will be. Somebody will be. But that's my future. So if I'm going to get there, I'm going to be this individual being treated. I want to make sure I treat them that way too. So make sure your heart's involved in this because you want that recipient or to be the recipient of that treatment too. And God's able to do all of this even though it's not written down in our Torahs, because he wrote down the tools of which he can do it with. The tools which he's allowed to operate inside and outside of the Torah. Now, he doesn't do anything that we understand that he hasn't written down. And if he does stuff that he didn't write down, we just don't understand it. It's pretty simple as that. So if it's not written down for us, we don't know about it. We can speculate. We don't know about it, though. He wrote down in his Torah the tools which he gave us to live by and the tools which he uses to shuffle around and move things around and flip our lives inside and out at different times for what's needed. And the tools which we need to survive anything he gives us. He wrote them all down for us. And we have to understand, when does one apply? When does one not? How do I, which one trumps? No. Coin president's name versus the other one. When does one have to overrule temporarily or permanently the other one? Some cases it's permanent, some cases it's temporary. It varies. But we understand this. Our God is a very unique individual because he had stated, if you recall, I'm going to go through it. I'm going to stop before I go all the, too much deeper into this. But we recall that he stated that oaths cannot be broken. Remember that? In the Torah, the commandments, you make a vow, you're stuck with it. Yes, Yephthah, you're stuck with it. So vows are oaths. You made an agreement, it's forever until the oath is fulfilled, the vow is fulfilled, right? So he made his agreements in spite of what the Torah says. He doesn't break his agreements and vows. Because he wrote them in there, he doesn't break them. So the Torah does not talk about a lot of things the prophets do discuss, about our future, how we treat other people, how we interact with our God, what our fasting is supposed to mean to us. The Torah does not discuss the afflicting one's soul, what that actually means. The prophets do. He's allowed to teach us outside the Torah's instruction. If we're able to teach that and learn it and follow it, that's our God. That's how our God works with us. We have our laws, we have our tools, we have our instructions, but we have our God that can move us around and move our lives around, move our existence around based on his oaths. Because which agreement did we contractually sign? Which one's better? The carbon copy, the one underneath. The one we didn't really pay attention to. That's the one that's a better one that you kept a hold of. That's a good one to follow. The one still exists, but the good one to follow is the one that was underneath that we didn't see. Does that make sense? Okay, so Day of Atonement is an important day. It's an important holy day, but it also, I want you to understand how valuable it is to understand the purpose behind it within inside you, how you treat the people, and how God works with us in and outside of the Torah and the commandments that he gave. Does that make sense? Any questions or comments around what I talked about today? I know your minds are half gone because of lack of water and food. I get that. That's right. We'll conclude with a prayer. Almighty God, our great Heavenly Father, thank you for our holy day, our time with you, our time to worship and to praise and to study. We ask you to bless us, Father, to help us to learn and to follow you as best we can. Father, you are a good, kind, compassionate Father. Help us to be those things as well. Help us to treat others the way you wish for us to treat them, and that we will be treated and how we pay attention. Pay attention to those who are in need. Father, we ask you to bless us the rest of our fasting day, our time with one another, the great things we have, and the stories to tell. We praise you, Father, and ask your blessing in Yeshua's name. Amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hillel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hillel.info. That's hallel.info, hallel.info.